Get a head start.
Okay, we have blue light. I will call to order this meeting of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee for Thursday, May 21st, 2009. And I'd like to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 8A. Welcome, Senator. Mr. Molina, if you could help us out here.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 8A comes to us from the Senate Healthcare and Veterans Affairs with a unanimous consent, and on the Senate floor with unanimous consent as well. This measure allows volunteer health practitioners who licensed in other states and registered with the Volunteer Health Practitioner Registration System to practice in Oregon during an emergency, eliminate the need for registry based on a current statute that establishes a registry for health care providers in 2003. It clarifies liability of volunteer health practitioners and allows the practitioners to receive benefits if injured during the emergency. It allows the Office of Emergency Management to adopt rules related to volunteer health practitioners. There are no amendments to this. There is no revenue impact. And we should have a fiscal statement issued before us from LFO.
We do.
Mm-hmm. The A and gross version. And that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Senator.
Hi, Madam Chair. Nice to see you. I'm Senator Lori Moniz-Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Trout, Deadwood Village in Fairview, and I'm delighted to bring before you Senate Bill 8. This legislation, as your good committee administrator said, is going to allow volunteer health practitioners licensed in other states and registered with a volunteer health practitioner registration system that Oregon already has for in-state volunteer health practitioners. This legislation came before you as a result of what happened in when Katrina hit in Louisiana. And there were two surgeons that responded to a call that they heard on CNN that they needed surgeons in the area. And so they did. They got in their car. They went to Louisiana and went into a hospital, and there were hospitals shutting down. So they were trying to find a hospital where they could practice, and they did find one on the coast. And when they got there, they found that the hospital administrator had to call their previous hospitals to get all their paperwork to make sure that they had their license and that they were actually qualified to do surgery. Well, the one surgeon, his hospital was closed. So he was not able to perform surgery and give relief to the surgeon that had been going 4 days straight without a break. He was in the hospital caring for all of these victims. The other surgeon, it took him maybe about 48 hours before he was able to practice surgery. So we do have a registry system, and I do believe that Grant Higginson will be here to explain a little bit about that. But this is something that we really need to have. Heaven forbid that we're going to have a disaster hit, but we could have a tsunami, we could have a major earthquake, and if we could have other physicians and surgeons, medical providers from other states sign up on our registry ahead of time, then they wouldn't have to go through this rigmarole to practice right here in the state. And oh, are you going to be with me on this one?
I believe he is. Good Senator, welcome. Would you like to join us here?
I thought what I was doing.
Welcome, President Courtney.
So now that I've said all of the good information, my fellow president colleague here can talk.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Am I supposed to testify now? I always wait until the chair invites me. I don't ever assume you want me to do anything until you
Senator
tell me.
Senator Courtney, would you like to go ahead now, please?
Yes, thank you. Chair Cowan and members of the House Veteran Emergency Services Committee, Representative Esquivel, Representative Freeman, Representative Matthews, Representative Riley, and Representative Widener.
Senator Courtney.
I'm very respectful. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem, in State Senate District 11. I think I had distributed the written testimony that I have, and I'll just briefly say that we know that happened in Hurricane Katrina. I did not know this, that apparently there was a lot of doctors that wanted to help, came into the state from other states, but unfortunately, because of licensing practices in one state versus another state, and the states not talking to each other, there were some problems, which I believe the good Senator Lloyd Montes Anderson has probably gone into or will go into. And that situation exists here in the great state of Oregon. And I do know, if you, and I'm sure you're aware of this, we're going to get hit with a very bad, at least we're going to get hit very bad with a super quake and tsunami. We do know that's coming. That's all been factually demonstrated. And so hopefully we will be ready in a lot of ways. But when you get hit with natural disasters, you need all the help you can get. And so we looked into the 2006, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, and they adopted a law to deal with the Katrina type of situation called the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioners Act. And this legislation allows a doctor or other health professional to volunteer during a declared emergency in a state where the professional is not licensed to practice. And that's what this legislation is. So you got to have a declared emergency in a state. It relates to doctors or other health professionals. It sort of covers the waterfront there. It establishes this bill, legal guidelines for recognizing the other states licensing physicians and other care practitioners who want to volunteer when we get into a bad situation in the great state of Oregon, my Oregon. So when I heard about the bill, I asked to help with it. And, of course, you don't have to help that much when the lead is taken by Senator Lloyd Montes Anderson. I'm basically a private, and I take orders. So I basically followed her around, and she helped get this out of the committees and onto the Senate floor and off the Senate floor. And so I thought I'd come today and basically help her do this once again, although I defer to the expertise and knowledge of the great chair and the individual as well as the collective wisdom of this committee in the House. Hopefully you'll seriously consider it. Hopefully you will feel it has merit, and hopefully, respectfully, deferentially, you will report it to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. So that's all I have to say, Chair Cowan.
Thank you, sir. We're honored to have you both with us today. Are there any questions for our distinguished panel? Representative Matthews.
Madam Chair, I'd just be remiss. I want to say thank you to President Courtney, of course, for your leadership, but I have to also say that the good Senator, Lori Montes Anderson, is from my area, and she's a personal friend, but also a mentor. And I just want to say how much, being a freshman, I appreciate your leadership, your guidance, and all your, your help throughout this first year. So thank you very much for your time and effort. And this bill to me seems extremely reasonable. During Hurricane Katrina, we had several firefighters from the state of Oregon that went and helped in the cause. It seems to me that in the times of need, we should also allow health practitioners and those doctors and nurses to do the same. So thanks for bringing it, but thanks for your friendship, your guidance, and your leadership. Senator, thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm just delighted. Mm-hmm. Just a minute. I'm delighted to have Representative Matthews as my state representative. I'm delighted that you are my president. Is that what you needed?
Why doesn't your House member call me a mentor? I want to be a mentor in the House.
While they're finishing their conversation, are there any other questions here? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator and President Courtney. Just reading through the bill here, and it says enter agreements with other states to facilitate the registry. How many other states currently are taking part in this process?
I think that Mr. Higginson can answer that question because this is a national movement that's happened since the Katrina happens, and I don't have that information. Do you?
I don't know. I understand there's an expert in the audience who is prepared to come and tell you other states are also looking at this legislation. I do not know that answer either, Chair Cowan, members of the committee.
Thank you. We do have Dr. Higginson waiting in the wings, and we've actually discussed this particular issue in relationship to some other bills, including House Bill 3021, which will be coming your way as well, and hopefully we can put some packages together here that will make things work better.
Excellent.
So, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And didn't this come forward in either 2005 or 2007 when we had the Joint Committee? Sasha's nodding.
Emergency preparedness? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is great. Thank you, both of you. You're my mentor, Senator President Courtney.
Okay, that's what he needed to hear.
Is there Representative Comp, yes, make sure you get your accolades.
I cannot be outdone. Senator Courtney is my hero. He has been somebody I've looked up to for a number of years, long before I was a member. So thank you for your wisdom.
What a great look.
So you had a mentor, too.
Do you want us all to take a crack at this or what?
I think
perhaps the choir has sung, but we are pleased that you took the time out of your schedule to come and talk to us. And in all sincerity, thank you for your work on this.
And
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Higginson?
He used to be my mentor when I was in public health.
Well, he's a good friend and someone that I respect a great deal as well, so we will listen with bated breath to your testimony.
Chair Cowan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I, too, am delighted to be here this afternoon and really do appreciate the leadership that Senators Courtney and Mona Anderson took on to get this bill before you. I think you've all heard the reasons why we need this kind of bill, so I'm not going to go into that. The bill, the original Senate Bill 8, came to be discussed as the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Practitioner Act, which you've heard from Senator Courtney. That's an initiative that's being sponsored by the American College of Surgeons. We had some concerns at the time because we already have a registry, and that was one of the things that the act called for. And so we worked with Senator Mona Anderson to gut and stuff the bill with amendments that make it much simpler bill and simply add to the current registry's responsibilities and authorities. So now the current registry, in addition to registering volunteer health care providers in the state of Oregon, we can also accept them from other states as well. It allows us to work with other states to facilitate getting those practitioners into the registry, and then allows those practitioners to practice here as if they were licensed in the state of Oregon in the event of a declared emergency. I think another thing that you heard was the reference to House Bill 3021, and what that is, well, you already know this bill, the Oregon Law Commission work on liability around emergency responders, and I think I can say that this bill is very consistent with the work that was trying to be accomplished in House Bill 3021, and the same liability protections that would be provided to in-state healthcare providers will be provided to out-of-state healthcare providers should they be deployed through the registry system. And with that, I'll close, although I will try to address Representative Wiedner's question. My understanding is that virtually all the states have registry systems. I think there still is some work to do to those registry systems in other states to allow the practice of other health care providers in the event of a declared emergency, and that's the purpose of the bill. But what this really allows us to do on a very personal basis is go work with Washington, go work with Idaho, go work with California, both with their licensing organizations and with their registry systems to help populate our registry.
Thank you. One of the references that Senator Courtney made was to declared emergency, and I haven't. Is that referenced in the amended version of the bill also?
If it's not, it's because. Chair Cowan, if it's not, it's because that part of the statute is not necessarily being changed.
Okay.
The registry is for the case of a declared emergency.
Okay, I may have missed that somewhere.
For a public health emergency.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I was trying to read three things at the same time and listen. Any questions for the good doctor? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Dr. Higginson. Can you tell us who your mentor is? You don't have to. Well, he's turning red.
It's
Well, Chair Callahan represented
Booth. You do not have to answer that question.
It's not exactly that question, but I do. I've had numerous mentors in my career. But one thing I do want people to know is that I really do respect the work that you do here. I think that everyone is trying to make good policy for the state of Oregon, and I'm very appreciative of the hard work that you put in, and I know what a tough job it is.
Was that the accolade you were searching for? Are there any other questions?
He does a great job too, Madam Chair.
Indeed he does, and we thank you for spending some time with us today too. Thank you. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? I don't have anything else signed up. Excuse me. Anyone else signed up? I'm going to get my tongue working any moment now. With that, then, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 8A and open a work session on Senate Bill 8A.
Madam Chair.
Representative Matthews.
I'd like to make a motion. We move Senate Bill 8A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Matthews moves Senate Bill 8A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, could you take a vote, please?
Aye.
Representative
Baskerville?
Aye.
Representative
Kong?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Freeman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Matthews?
Aye.
Chair Callahan?
Aye.
Senate Bill 8A, having received the required majority, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Does anyone desperately want to carry this bill, or shall I?
Well, if you would like to, Madam Chair, otherwise I'm volunteering, whatever you prefer.
He does a pretty good job.
Well, he does.
Might make you wait for 2 minutes.
Except on motorcycle insurance.
All right, Representative Matthews, if you can keep this one moving forward smoothly, you can carry this bill.
A little quicker than earlier today.
I shall do so.
Thank you. Just don't miss the motorcycle.
With that, I open up, and let's stop that discussion right now, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 400. Mr. Molina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 400 comes to us from the Senate Health Care and Veterans Affairs, where they held two hearings, passed with unanimous consent, both in the committee and on the floor. This authorizes the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to issue a shellfish license to veterans at no charge with written proof of veteran status, and shows the person to be at least 25% disabled. We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this, on a dash two. The dash two permits the cost-free shellfish license fees for resident disabled veterans who show 25% disability. There is a piece on the amendment that you will have before you related to Senate Bill 96. As you recall, Senate Bill 96 was a bill that we passed in our committee related to standardizing the definition of veteran in statute. So you'll see that as well.
Okay. Senator Cruz wanted to be here for this bill, but I don't see him yet. Kurt, could you maybe bring us up to date? And are you able to speak to the amendment as well, or is that something different?
Okay. I had a quick look at it, so I'm happy to.
Terrific. Thank you. So this is an amendment that's requested of us on this side. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to get my head around this a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and give you some brief comments on Senate Bill 400. As the committee administrator mentioned, Senate Bill 400 would authorize the Fish and Wildlife Commission to issue a free recreational shellfish license to resident disabled war veterans. And the shellfish license would program then would be identical to the current programs that we have for issuing free fishing licenses and free hunting licenses to the same population.
Okay, I got you.
In 2008, for instance, we issued almost 9,000 free fishing and hunting licenses to disabled veterans that met the 25% criteria as described in statute. And of those 8,800 individuals that received free licenses. We also then subsequently sold 1,600 of them a shellfish license for $6.50. So with the adoption and implementation of this program, of course, there would be a small reduction in revenue associated with our shellfish license, although it is a small reduction. Administratively, this bill does not create any additional workload for our staff. Our staff is already essentially certifying that these folks meet the criteria, as they are, many of them, already receiving free fishing and hunting licenses. So there's no administrative additional administrative cost or workload associated with this. And as I did mention, it makes the shellfish license entirely consistent with our fishing and hunting licenses. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I will provide a written copy of my testimony subsequent to this hearing through the committee administrator.
Thank you. You did mention that there would be some revenue reduction. Do we have a fiscal statement?
$8,000.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. That's correct.
Did I miss that?
That's correct.
You just said 1,600 of them.
Yeah.
Oh, you were doing the math for me. Got it. Okay, so I'm looking at the official document here. It's considered a minimal expenditure, and the department is comfortable with that then. Is that correct?
Chair Callen, this is entirely consistent with the way we treat fishing and hunting licenses, so we see that is consistent. Don't have a problem.
Okay. Any specific questions? Okay, Representative Kahn?
Thank you, Chair Callen. And I'm not being facetious, but could you list off several shellfish?
Sure. Chair Callen, Representative Comp, the shellfish license in the state of Oregon is good for all shellfish. So, for instance, individuals who are harvesting Dungeness crab recreationally, razor clams, bay clams in any of our bays, all would come under the purview and be required to have a shellfish recreational shellfish license.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Comment. For many years, I used to go dig quahog clams out of Neatarts Bay, and I think any veteran that wants to go do that should do it free.
I would agree. I'm still working with Representative Boone for my share of her razor clams because I don't dig them either. Representative Boone.
Well, are you in luck, Madam Chair, because Saturday there's a minus 1.1 tide.
Ooh, I can't
what
wait.
Time?
7:30? Astoria time, so whatever figures.
Did you have a question?
I was just going to say thank you to Kurt. That's a very nice thing for the department to continue to build on what you're doing. It's one way you can help our vets, and I know they appreciate it. I am willing to share the sand with some of them.
Senator Cruz has joined us, and I believe you wanted to speak to this bill. Is that correct? Good, sir. I'm sure that he'd welcome you joining him here. I believe he has given us the basics, but welcome to our committee.
And we have met.
Yes, so. Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. This was a constituent bill. It's very seldom that they go very far, but in this case, it seemed... the constituent said, you know, we appreciate what you've done for disabled vets, but here's a little glitch in what you did, and this is just to fill that. And by the way, we considered amending the bill on the Senate side because it says 25% disabled. The VA does not recognize those percentages. They go 20 or 30, so this would mean 30% disabled, which is fine. It's what was intended anyway. And quite honestly, a 30% disabled veteran is a pretty disabled veteran. So, you know, I think it's the least we can do for those who have sacrificed so much for us, and I truly appreciate the department's willingness to move forward with this. It's a very simple thing, and it helps some very deserving people.
Thank you. One second here, Representative Matthews and then Representative Widener, but I wanted to also make note for you, Senator Cruz, that we do have a -2 amendment that comes from Legislative Council and I think deals with just sort of clarifying language in the law in some other work that we've done. So I wanted to let you know not to be surprised if it comes back to you for needing concurrence.
Yeah, conforming language is fine.
and so that, I believe that's
we expect that on a regular basis, as you all know.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, what other permits might exist out there that you would consider in the future? Is this, you know, when we're looking at, if you were to expand this, and I'm not saying that's what we're heading to do, but I'm just curious what other permits or licenses would be out there that, did you consider others along with this, or this was a constituent issue that...
This was, we've already done this for most licenses for disabled veterans. This was just kind of... I think it was an unintentional miss, because the way law is constructed, sometimes you can do something that covers, quote-unquote, the universe except for this planet over here. And so that's really all this was intended to do, was to fill in a gap.
Okay.
Kurt, if I'm correct, I think in an earlier conversation, part of it was that these shellfish licenses came into being fairly recently.
Yes.
Subsequent to when we made the action on other fish, hunting and fishing. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's precisely correct.
Yeah. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you happen to know the number difference between 20% and 30% disabled? So if we...
The number of people.
10%.
The number of people.
The number of people.
That would be 10.
The number of eligible veterans between 20% disabled and 30% disabled.
Chair Callen, Representative Widener, I do not know that. I'm sure that there are experts here in the veteran community that could tell you that, or that could tell the committee that. But I, off the top of my head, I do not know the answer to that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, just let me say that when this program first came forward, it was brought by the vets, and this was the number they chose. So based on that, this is where they wanted to be. They wanted it to be disabled vets, not partially disabled, and so this was the number they chose, and we've been comfortable going with their number. And the information you got from the department was based on the number of participants now at 30%. What there would be, I'm not sure. I mean, it would be speculative at this point to, number one, find out the number difference between 20 and 30, and then the other issue would be how many of them would want to take advantage. And so it would be a very speculative number.
Brief follow-up. You want one? You covered? Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Freeman?
Thank you, Chair Callen, and I'll explain this to you later. Matthew started this. Jeff Cruz is my senator, and I'd like to welcome you here today. And you are my hero, and you're my mentor, and thanks for being here.
Okay, I'll look forward to the explanation.
Senator, President Courtney was here a few minutes ago. Do you understand now?
Okay. Peter Courtney,
as well as Senator
I'm
Mona Sanderson.
Think about that one for a while.
No, never mind. This committee has gotten a little out of control today, but I've got this big hammer, and we'll see what we can do here. Are there any other questions for these two presenters on this bill?
Good way to ask.
Thank you very much, committee.
And I believe, Senator, you're going to stick around for the next one. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think
yeah we'll be. Okay, we'll get there in just a second then. Thank you. Well, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 400. We do have a fiscal with. Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 400, and I would remind you that we have the Dash 2 amendments here before us as well. Representative Matthews?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 400.
Representative Matthews has moved approval of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 400. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, we will move the Dash 2 amendments, and I think we are ready for a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Matthews moves Senate Bill 400 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Debbie, could you call the roll?
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Escobel?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Freeman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Matthews?
Aye.
Chair Callen?
Aye. Senate Bill 400, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Boone, would you like to carry this one? You're
I'd be
the
delighted.
Shellfish person that I'm aware of.
A clam woman from the North Coast. Yep.
Thank you very much. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 400. And open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 556.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 556A comes to us from the Senate Healthcare and Veterans Affairs. With unanimous consent and the floor as well. They heard it four times there. This does not have a revenue impact. We have the fiscal statement before us on the A engrossed. This bill requires certain places of public assembly defined as a facility of 50,000 square feet or more and at least 25 individuals congregated on a normal business day to have automated external defibrillators. And to ensure that staff persons are trained in the use of the defibrillator and present and present when the place of public assembly is open to the public.
I'm sorry, Mr. Molina, that is defibrillator.
Defibrillator.
Never mind.
So AED stands for?
Never mind.
Automatic. Never mind.
AED.
All right.
There you go.
If we got it back together, we are pleased to welcome the next team of Senators Hass and Cruz. This is a day of welcoming a distinguished guest. See, now I can't say that one. So. And having just spotted the camera, they're getting organized.
Chair Cowan and committee, Mark Hass, Senate District 14. I could go through the bill with you. You asked me to do a little demonstration of what this is, and
on Senator Cruz.
Throw you up on the floor.
Yes.
Okay. actually, when we talked about this bill, one of the concerns that I'm assuming that everyone understands that these are devices used in cases of sudden cardiac problems. And I'm going to let you explain it more thoroughly, but my concern, or what I wanted you to address, is that these are devices that don't allow you to simply put the paddles on somebody's chest and shock them whether or not it is required, because that, in fact, can be a life-threatening or thing to do if a person doesn't need it.
Chair Cowan, let me teach you to fish for life, or however that saying goes. And I think that the thing about when you hear about training for these things is the only training that's necessary for AEDs is that there's no training needed. And so when you see one of these, you unzip it, on-off switch.
Apply pads to patient's bare chest.
Okay, it's
okay. Not unless the camera's turned off.
I'm not going to utilize a heart rhythm.
Okay, this is on the bare chest.
Touch the patient.
So this is detecting whether there is heart arrhythmia right now. And if there's not...
Analyzing heart rhythm.
If there's not, it won't shock
no
the person.
No shock advised.
No shock advised.
It is safe to touch the patient.
So,
check airway. Check breathing. Check pulse. If needed, begin CPR.
See, so it gives you these other ideas, you know, to pursue something else. And that's it. That is it. You just went through a training course. And, you know, there's none of this yelling clear or doing all of these other things. And I
not
couldn't,
nearly as exciting.
I couldn't administer this charge if I wanted to. And I have to tell you something, that about a year and a half ago, I was in an emergency situation with one of these. And there was a man in front of me with no pulse, turning purple.
Where were you, Mark?
We were in the state capitol.
Okay.
And he was dead. And thankfully, we did have one of these. Someone ran out and got it. And we just went through that drill, and it said, instead of saying there's no problem, it said administer charge, hit the orange button. And so I did, and he just rocked up off the floor. There was a big explosion, And a few seconds later, he started coughing. And he came back. And literally, you know, his eyes blinked, and, you know, he said that thing that we all see in movies, where am I? And why am I on the floor? And he came back to live another day because of this. And we see this over and over, and I know you have some experts, more expert on this than I do. But these are our lifesavers. I said before that these are the new fire extinguishers of this century, that they're not going to be used much, but when they're used and when they're needed, they'll save lives. I got into this about 7 years ago when there was a Beaverton 7-year-old who had heart arrhythmia. He was pulled out of a swimming pool by two doctors and two lifeguards, and they couldn't save him. One of the doctors was a cardiac surgeon, and he said, we didn't need any doctors or lifeguards. We needed one of these. And so I started going to these conferences and becoming more interested, and 2005, we passed the bill to get these into schools and health clinics. And I'd go to these conferences, and usually they would start with somebody stepping to the microphone and say, hi, my name is Joe Smith, and 6 months ago I died, and one of these things brought me back to life. All of the golf courses figured these out long ago with, you know, people a little bit older, hot weather, you know, strenuous exercise, that sort of thing. So I started working about a year ago with business and talking to them about how could we get these into commercial buildings. Because I, in my other life, work in Portland in a 20-story office tower where we don't have one of these. And if I would have been in that situation that I spoke of just a few minutes ago, that person would have died and not come back. And yes, we could have called 911, and yes, paramedics would have been on the scene, but after a few minutes, as you'll hear today, the lack of oxygen to the brain, and you have serious brain damage, and you only have a couple of minutes. And there is too long. In my situation with the Capitol, the paramedics showed up very speedily, but it was about 12 minutes after, and that was too long. So business said yes, and I was at first afraid that they were gonna say this is too expensive, but they said, you know, with all of the codes that we have in buildings today, from heating and ventilation and all of this, the cost, which is about $1,000 to $1,500, depending on how many, you know, what kind you buy, is not an issue. What was an issue with business was liability. Oregon already has a pretty broad Good Samaritan law, but they wanted more. And so in this bill, as you see, there's immunity from anything that goes wrong with one of these when they're attempted to use, with the exception of gross neglect. And I didn't think that was unreasonable. And so it's why the Building Owners and Manufacturers Association has come out with an enthusiastic neutral, and other businesses are on board and support. So that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you.
If I could, Madam Chair, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, sponsor of the bill that got it in public buildings a few years ago, and I think this is the next step. For the record, we considered schools this time, but in this economic environment, even a little bit of an imposition on schools is probably more than we should do. So we will address that issue probably at a future date. But I do want to thank Senator Haas, because I liked where he was going, and this isn't just every business building. This is significant business buildings, but one issue that we discovered after the bill was drafted was that I have two buildings in my business that would have qualified. One is a hay barn and one is an equipment shed. Okay, I really don't think my hay barn needs a defibrillator, because last time I checked, hay does not have a pulse. And so we further defined the bill to the number of people present to make sure. I mean, you go up and down I-5 in the Willamette Valley, you see a lot of major buildings that have nobody in them, and to have defibrillators in those, would, although convenient maybe, didn't necessarily make sense. So I appreciate Senator Hess being willing to accommodate that concern, and so we're truly dealing with major buildings where there are actual people, and this will save lives. This is not a major expense for the benefit we get out of it. Is it an unfunded mandate on the private sector? Yeah, kinda. But wouldn't it be nice if for example, Portland replaced Seattle as the best place in the world to have a heart attack, because Seattle does have that reputation now because of all the EMT training, because they have these machines, and we could be in the same boat. So I fully support this. This saves lives, and I urge you folks to pass it on to the floor.
Thank you for bringing it to us today, Representative Boone, and then Representative Freeman, and we do have several other people who'd like to testify.
I just wanted to say to Senator Cruz, I bet a lot of schools have it already, and churches and big, you know.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, they do. We just didn't feel it was the right time to do an additional mandate on schools with all of the other issues they're dealing with. So we will do a study in the interim and try to assess the cost. And in fact, I believe Senator Bates was going to look in to see if there were grant funds available to kind of expand this. So.
Thank you. Small follow-up.
Brief follow-up.
I just had to ask Senator Hess, what was the explosion? Who exploded?
It was the sound of the electrical current coming
okay.
through the pads. It was the shock.
Senator Freeman?
Thank you, Chair Cowan. And thank you, Senators, for being here. I should probably declare a conflict of interest because I'm overweight and probably will need one of these at some point. I have a history in my family of early heart attacks, so, but that isn't my question. My question is kind of the definition of where these will be required. Was there any discussion about inside or outside facilities, malls that have a much broken up space? Does that count? Kind of how does that work?
The building's over 50,000 square feet. Just to give you a bearing on that, a full city block, one story is 40,000 square feet.
Okay.
And this says you have to have at least one. So
a mall with a bunch of different. Sorry, follow up.
Yeah,
a mall with a bunch of different businesses would qualify.
Not the individual businesses, but yes, the mall.
Well, the mall itself would have to have one, not each business that's within that large square footprint. And then, how about outside facilities? Sorry, follow up.
One more follow up.
Okay, then I'll be done. How about outside facilities? Like say a big outside swap meet that had a bunch of people and it was open air. Not really a building, but a kind of a, it would have a big footprint.
Well, it's just the building as defined in the statutes. I would not think it would be to a swap meet, especially temporary.
Okay.
Yeah. And Senator Cruz is right, by the way. The Senate committee added the individuals, 25 individuals, so as to not make this a burden for those storage facilities or large warehouses where there's only three or four employees.
Thank you, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going through it, looked at everything on the bill here, and some of those large warehouses are sitting up to 25, 50 employees, the cold storage buildings, and they're going to fall under this. Just wondering if you have maybe a tax incentive or some relief for the businesses to buy this to where they can write this off. If we're going to mandate that they have to put it in, we should give them a break.
Well, Chair Cowan, Representative Winter, it is a business expense, so they can write this off. This would be a business expense.
But it's a small percentage, and I'm thinking about for stuff like this, we should be giving 100% credit on.
Madam Chair, Representative Winter, we did not think about that. In my judgment, a facility like the cold storage facilities north of here would qualify, but my judgment, having done business with them, I think they could afford the $1,000. So, you know, any facility that is in that big of a scope and is actually in business has significant other expenses as well. I, you know, if I'd have thought this was going to be an undue burden, I would have had trouble with it, but I think the scope of the structure we're talking about and also the expansion of people present to 25 kind of keeps it in the realm of, you know, for example, a shopping center, could they afford this? Not only do I think they could, but they probably should have one. So I don't think this is an undue imposition on anybody. So, but that's my opinion.
Representative Baskerville, did you have a question?
No, I think it's been answered, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. I think one quick follow-up, and then we'll move on to the good doctor who's waiting. The temporary accommodations of large groups of people, I that actually keyed a thought process in my mind. It says the public congregates for purposes such as deliberation, shopping, entertainment, amusement. Will this apply to temporary things like, you know, Saturday markets or the gatherings on the waterfront or?
Typically, those, Chair Cowan, are outside, so it would not.
It's not a building, so that's the difference.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, you put up a tent, you haven't put up a building. I mean, for example.
If you've put up a tent, you've put up a building?
You have not put up a building.
You have not put up a building.
It does not qualify as a building. So you have to. It has to be a permanent structure to even be in the consideration.
I see. Thank you. Thank you for bringing the show and tell.
Thank you for not making him try it on me. I appreciate that, too.
I wanted to see you explode.
I really did not want to stop your heart, sir.
You would have made the sunny die tape, though, probably.
Yeah, that is true.
I think it already has with Dave.
Dr. Stackham?
Big hit for the day. I can just see him doing it with you.
Stecker, I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. Just want to make sure I'm the right one.
The only one on the list that has doctor in front of his name here. Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity. I'm Dr. Eric Stecker. I'm a cardiologist, assistant professor in cardiology at OHSU. I'm an electrophysiologist, which is the subspecialty of cardiology that focuses on arrhythmias, and including the ones that cause cardiac arrest. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Departing from my prepared remarks, I wanted to, first of all, apologize to the senators for not being able to come, scheduling conflicts, not being able to come to the Senate committee. I wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, and this committee for taking the time and the legislative effort to deal with the issues of sudden cardiac death, which are very important to me and to a lot of people. OHSU supports Senate Bill 556, which requires certain places of public assembly to have an automated external defibrillator, which is hard for me to say as well sometimes. I'll say AED from now on.
Okay.
The legislation also requires that the owner of the place of public assembly have a staff person trained in use of AEDs. I wanted to talk a little bit about the issues that Senate Bill 556 will help to address. Out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is a big issue in the United States, and you'll see some numbers in my testimony here. There are between 200,000 and 400,000 people per year in the United States who suffer an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. 90 to 95% of the time, that's fatal. So this is a very common and very lethal medical problem. Most recoverable, I think, something that's important to clarify is that most recoverable arrhythmias don't respond to CPR alone. So despite what you see on TV, you don't do CPR and do several minutes of CPR and then have the patient wake up and start coughing out a little bit of water and recover. CPR, the purpose of CPR, by and large, somewhat of a simplification, but not too much, is to keep the brain and the heart alive long enough to be defibrillated. The odds of mortality increase by about 10% for every minute it takes for defibrillation. So if you're waiting 5 minutes, you've increased the mortality rate of the patient by more than 50%. And in fact, there's an exponential process to this as well. So really, within those first 5 minutes, the ability to save somebody is dramatically higher than in subsequent 5, 10, or 15 minutes, even if CPR is happening. Public access defibrillation is an approach to responding to out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in which non-medical personnel are trained in advanced CPR and can use an AED. This has been an approach that's been tested, and I'll tell you about it a little bit more in a second. But I would like to reiterate what the senator said as well, which is these devices are not complicated, and it's I think people are working toward, and it's very conceivable that if policy would change, that somebody could just put on an AED. You don't have to have any training; just know what it is, and know that you're supposed to open it up and listen to the instructions. And that alone, with almost no risk, which I'll also address here, can save lives. This is the approach that Senate Bill 556, as I understand it, supports. I should say for the record, hopefully I stated that this is also supported officially by OHSU. I think that's important. Hopefully I said that. So public access defibrillation training programs include plans where volunteers can be trained in the use of CPR and how to use the defibrillator officially. When the way it works, as you saw here, the machine is open, pads are placed on the patient. The machine then analyzes the patient's rhythm and decides whether it's a defibrillatable rhythm, whether it can be shocked, whether it should be shocked. If the machine decides it should be shocked, it does not automatically shock the patient. It then advises that the patient, that the EMS responder or the layperson press a button to deliver the shock. The machine can't shock the patient by itself, and the EMS person or the relay responder cannot shock the person without the machine agreeing. It's kind of like the nuclear switch, you know, where you have to have two keys or something. After the shock has been administered, very importantly, the pads are stuck on the patient. The machine reanalyzes the rhythm and continues to tell you what to do should you shock again. Sometimes it takes more than one shock. Other times a person will go back into normal rhythm, but then they'll go back into a life-threatening arrhythmia, and the machine can then reanalyze and advise another shock. Just to reiterate that AEDs have been extensively tested to ensure that they work function appropriately. There was a large, jumping around a bit in my testimony, all of this is in the written testimony, but there was a large trial of a very large and very well done trial in New England Journal of Medicine 1994, I think, in which an approach of using AEDs and trained lay people was tested. It was tested in community units. You'd take a building and that would be a community unit. They randomized about almost 1,000 of these community units and trained about 19,000 people. And they found that the odds of successfully surviving a cardiac arrest doubled when you had the AEDs available compared to when you simply had people, all kinds of people trained in advanced CPR. So both groups had active interventions. One was CPR, one was CPR plus AEDs. They found in this study that that a cardiac arrest took place on average for each AED placed in service, took place on average once for each AED placed in service per 3 years of follow-up. Their conclusion was that it would be worth using AEDs, and this is not terribly evidence-based, but this is people who know a lot about this. Their conclusion was that it would be worth using an AED in places where you have a witnessed cardiac arrest every 9 years, so not frequent. You know, it's one a decade would warrant one of these. In my opinion, this is just my opinion, but you perhaps could have an even greater benefit in observed public places when emergency response times may be a bit prolonged, which potentially could be the case in some rural areas where you have places of public gathering, but you may not have a full-time EMS service, or you may have EMS that has to come from afar. There's a typo in the minutes. I meant to say just for speculation, for instance, when response times are greater than 10 minutes. the written response of 6 to 10, I meant greater than 10 minutes. In conclusion, access to AEDs in public areas has proven in high-quality science to dramatically increase the likelihood of surviving a sudden cardiac arrest. I personally support the provisions of Senate Bill 556, as does OHSU. Thank you very much for the opportunity and for taking the time to deal with this issue.
Thank you very much for coming today. Are there any questions of the doctor? Representative Riley.
Thank you. I just wondered if these are available for anyone to buy.
They are. I don't know. I don't recall if they require a prescription. I probably do. But, yeah, there are home AEDs available. That the benefit of that approach is the jury is a little bit still out. As to what the degree of benefit is there benefit and what is the degree? There's no question in my mind about the approach in this Senate bill, about the benefit of that.
Follow up, please.
Quick follow up.
I don't quite get what you mean by the benefit. If you mean a cost-benefit analysis, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Because that's a lot different than the benefit if somebody happens to have a heart attack.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
And you're talking about cost-benefit analysis.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to speculate. It wouldn't be beneficial, just it kind of is it worth it?
Right. Yeah.
There's a whole new line of speculation that we won't get into. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. Two quick questions. One is, where does somebody buy it? And the other is a little bit on the liability, but a little different than the medical liability. I'm kind of curious, and I'll describe kind of what I see possibly happening and how this would work out. A lady's walking down the mall, and she passes out. Representative Esquivel decides that she's having a heart attack and applies this apparatus to her bare chest. And in fact, she's just fainted. She could be fairly upset about her shirt being open and this apparatus being applied to her. How does that work?
Well, goes to jail.
Representative Freeman, Madam Chair, first question, where do you buy one? I don't honestly know. I haven't bought one. And the patients that I see end up getting these implanted devices typically. So I would think it would be fairly easy to do, but I don't know for sure. With regard to the issue that you bring up, you know, I think it's an interesting and an important issue from the perspective of, you know, if you have these things out there, I guess you're asking, you know, I've told you that they're not dangerous, that you're not going to harm someone, but you bring up the issue of, you know, just placing one on and public embarrassment. I deal with a lot, in my subspecialty, I deal with a lot of patients with syncope who pass out as well. And in my experience, by the time, usually a person who, I'm sorry, I forgot to turn off my pager. From my experience, from a person who passes out from a benign cause, by the time you get the defibrillator over there, there's typically an indication that they are not having a cardiac arrest. It still takes a minute or two to get this thing. You see the patient go down. You activate. You yell to activate EMS. You yell for somebody to get one of these. By the time it gets over there, you can usually see that somebody's still having some breathing, or there's still some indication that they're not, you know, dying, as the senator pointed out. So I can't say that wouldn't happen, but you know, in my estimation, the odds that something like that would happen compared to the odds that not just one life, but multiple lives potentially could be saved by the same device. I think it would favor the device, using the device to save a life, rather than that somebody would be very embarrassed by not being needed.
Thank you.
I'm going to take a little bit of prerogative here, and I think that these devices are very important. I'm supportive of this bill, but it doesn't take away from basic responsibility of the ABC standards that we've taught for years, airway, breathing, and circulation. When somebody falls, you make sure their airway's open. You shake them to see if they're going to respond to you. You can check for a pulse without putting these devices on the chest while you're calling for somebody to bring something by. So, you know, the general public needs, I think, to think about the basic responsibilities as well. So there, I couldn't help it. That's
if I
the
could,
old
well,
CPR instructor in me. I cannot help myself.
I mean, you bring up a really important, and I thought a little bit about whether to bring up that kind of point too. And part of it for me is the need to defibrillate quickly. I personally feel we should get these things on quickly and that any delays for these other reasons may lose lives. That being said, under the current CPR standards, you wouldn't just put this on this lady. You'd be checking a pulse and breathing, as you mentioned.
Thank you. Representative Widener, quickly, I have several others, and we only have about 10 minutes left.
Representative Freeman, there's AED Superstores, 800-544-0048, for the record. All kinds of defibrillators. I didn't realize there was a super store for AEDs.
We have interesting technology available to us here. So thank you very much. Are there any other specific questions for the good doctor? Thank you very much for
your
time this morning.
So
we appreciate it. Bill Cross and Christine Johnson, we'll bring you up at the same time if we could, please. And then we will move to Joe Gilliam, Gary Oxley, and Kyle Gorman. Hello.
Good afternoon, Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I am here today representing BOMA, the Commercial Building Owners and Managers Association. And we worked with Senator Haas during the interim on this legislation. He did a very good job working and lobbying our legislative committee, our board, on this proposal. We worked with him then on some language to help narrow the liability because this will be a precedent. In no other state have they required commercial buildings to have the AEDs. And it's obviously... I mean, you have heard the benefits to the occupants and visitors of that building. But I would argue with Senator Cruz that this is not kind of a mandate. It is a mandate, and it will cost businesses. And, yes, to the degree they can make it a business deduction, they certainly will. But I don't need to remind you that we are in troubled times, and this is a... definitely a step above and beyond, I believe, for commercial building owners and other property owners that will fit this definition to support this bill. And actually, we're not what I would call support. We are enthusiastically neutral because it is hard to get a business group to look at actually these kind of costs. The good news is, and the sponsor, the good news is that the costs are coming down on this equipment, and by the time the effective date of 2016 reaches us, it should be very affordable. That is correct on the effective date? No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry,
okay,
I wasn't obviously not.
We are prepared, though, for working with the legislature on implementing this legislation if you go ahead and approve it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson?
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm here as a parent of a child that was lost to sudden cardiac arrest because of underlying heart condition that was misdiagnosed. And if you don't mind, I have a visual aid, too. He had the AED, and this is my son, Eddie Barnett, Jr. And yesterday, he would have been 21 years old.
I'm sorry.
He died at 16 while he was playing basketball for Grand High School in Portland. And there was no AED. There was no trainer. It took 8 minutes for the emergency team to get there, which you heard in other testimonies is too long, so he was DOA when we got to the hospital. I was present at the game, and one of the other issues with sudden cardiac arrest that I found out the hard way is that a lot of times you don't recognize it because it looked as if he was having a seizure, so no CPR was done at all. So after 8 minutes, he was brain dead and taken to the hospital, and they worked on him for over an hour. But because he was so young, they just didn't want to give up on him, and I had to watch that. And so though I respect, and I I want to add that I've worked with Senator Hass since his death in 05, and we got the law passed for the schools and the fitness center, and I'm happy to be here to testify on this bill that's coming up, because in my efforts since my son's death in establishing a foundation, donating AEDs to people that would accept them, I've worked with Commissioner Leonard at the City of Portland, Portland Trailblazers in Providence, and now they're gonna put resources together, and put them in all the high schools. Start out with the high schools. So I've gotten them to do that. My next thing was trying to get them in all the businesses. So I go around personally, and I've gotten Chuck E. Cheese to put them in, and I'm talking to car dealerships. I mean, anywhere where you have people coming in and out and staff members. So this is like a perfect situation. And though I respect the budgetary considerations that you guys have to, you know, make, my son's funeral cost 10 times the amount of one machine. So when we're talking about $1,000 to save a life as opposed to $13,000, $14,000 to bury him, and the only person people I see benefiting from it is the mortuaries and cemeteries. So I'm here to say on the other end of the spectrum, I didn't see a save. I hear about them. I'm kind of jealous because I didn't know about this stuff until this happened. But I'm here to try to help other people not have to experience what I went through. And as far as money and laws, and I'm learning how it works by coming down here so many times to testify. I mean, how many people had to die before we made a seatbelt law? How many people had to die before the insurance it was required to be put on cars to pay for injuries and stuff like that. So it's all, to me, it's a matter of priority. And sometimes until it happens to you, you don't realize how high that priority is. But I'm here to say that it is no loss worse than what I experienced 4 years ago, February. So basically, I ask that you pass it with no reservations, and I'm sure any one of you, if something happened to you, would want something there to save your life. And as far as what they were talking about is buying, you asked a question about buying them, purchasing them. There are so many AED distributors out there, and I have one in my car now, so I carry it in my trunk. And I don't worry about the liability, because one of the things I learned from working with all of this is that if somebody's dead, there's no such thing as debtor. So the worst you could do is, like, crack a rib giving them, you know, the CPR. And then, like they said, and I've experienced the shock, it's not going to happen unless it's been told to, or the rhythm has been assessed with the machine. So I carry one in my car. You can buy them from distributors. I donate them to people as I raise money through my foundation. It's really no excuse.
Thank you very much for coming today. Again, thanks for telling your story again. It's very important, and it's appreciated. You have our empathy for your loss.
Thank you.
Are there any questions of this? Thank you very much for
coming.
You're
welcome.
Joe Gilliam, Gary Oxley, and Kyle Gorman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of Fred Meyer Stores, one of the largest employers in the state of Oregon, and also on behalf of the Oregon Trail Chapter of the American Red Cross. The few comments I'm going to make in support of this bill, frankly, are totally insignificant in comparison to the compelling testimony I think you just heard for the reason to pass this bill. Very briefly, Fred Meyer, who operates 50 stores in this state, has approximately several 12,000 people per day traveling through each and every one of those stores. When this bill was presented to us by Senator Hass, we did have an issue concerning the liability. That has been significantly addressed. I think the Senator has done an excellent job of addressing that piece of concern we had. We strongly support this bill, as does the Red Cross. So we strongly, strongly urge you to pass this bill and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Joe Gilliam, Northwest Grocery Association. We also are in support of this bill, working with Senator Hass on it. He did listen to our concerns. The liability is obviously a big issue. They are expensive little units. There's money being outlaid for them. The industry is willing to do that. We think it has merit, but we were concerned about the liability issue, and I think that's been cleared up. So from the business side and somebody who operates, you know, over 500 locations that are going to have these units, we say give it a green light.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the executive officer of Clackamas Fire District Number 1 and a paramedic and a self-proclaimed evangelist for AEDs. And in that regard, I would hope that you would support this bill. I want to let you know, repeat what Dr. Stecker said, that your likelihood of survival decreases about the rate of 10% for every minute that passes. And CPR doesn't save your life. It just keeps you stable until electricity can be applied. So while we see on TV a lot of CPR and a lot of shocks being delivered, the likelihood of survival in the United States from cardiac arrest is around 6%. The likelihood of survival on TV from cardiac arrest is around 80%. So I think that there's a miscalculation among the public about what your chances of survival are, and it's really quite small unless an AED is present. At Clackamas Fire, we've deployed about 200 AEDs in the community in the last 4 years since the anniversary of Eddie Barnett's death, and you may see a number of us wearing these red wristbands with Eddie Barnett's initials on them in recognition of what he and his family have caused for the awareness of AEDs around the community. We have our foundation. If you want to put an AED in your business, I'd recommend that you move your business to Clackamas County, because our foundation will provide you with $500, up to $500, toward the purchase price of the AED if you'll put it in your business and hang a sign and train your people. So we'll cover about half the cost. And that will really allow businesses to put them in. The one problem that we've had, the one sort of issue that we've had, is some of the major commercial operations that have multiple residents. The commercial operations really don't want to take the liability to put them in there when they would serve a number of different areas. And in particular, this applies to medical office buildings where you have a number of physicians and dentists and so on, all occupying the same building, and they're forced to really go out and individually buy AEDs for their office with our support instead of putting one in a common area that where there's access for everyone. There was a question about whether a prescription is required for AEDs. The short answer to that is yes and no. Some AEDs available on the market are available without an AED, but not every AED can be purchased without a prescription. So it just depends on the model you're purchasing. But generally speaking, you don't need a physician's prescription to purchase an AED. Where do you buy one? Go to clackamasfire.com and click on our foundation tab and go look at our foundation information, and we'll have information on the local sources for AEDs if you're willing to do that. I do have one question, and maybe it's my dyslexia or what I'm concerned about is in section 4 It says that subsections 2 and 3 do not apply to schools and churches, basically. But subsection 3 is the section that protects organizations against liability. So I wonder if it's the intent of the law to exclude schools and churches from the liability protections. It's just not clear to me. And if I would just recommend that the committee make it clear that it's their intent to protect schools and churches and all building owners from that protection. So thank you for your time, and I hope you will support this bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to say very refreshing to have Fred Meyer step forward, and our grocery stores, thank you very much. Mr. Gilliam, I served with your father in this building, and he's a wonderful man. And let him know I said that.
Please, let's not start this.
But I want to say, Clackamas Fire, thanks for stepping up, being the leader. And as a firefighter, I can tell you that we only welcome more businesses to participate out there to minimize the impact of the damages to our folks and to help us in this quest to save lives, because it is really frustrating when you're already 6 minutes, 8 minutes behind. And it's great to be able to go on and have these life-changing experiences and to be able to produce a positive result. So this only helps us get there, and I'm looking forward to looking at your website and referring others to it too. But thanks, gentlemen, for being here, and thanks for your testimony.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming. Committee, I think that the question raised about the Section 4 and Section 3 is an interesting question that we might want to explore the answer to before we move this. And in light of the hour, I think that we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556 and bring it back for a work session on Tuesday.
Absolutely.
Anything else before the committee today? With that, I will close the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. Could you do that? Could you do a little explanation of that question? That would be interesting. After what big